is there a role for courts in medical futility decisions at the bedside? That's the question for this edition of the Bioethics Channel, a production of the Center for Practical Bioethics. For more information about the center and its programs, visit practicalbioethics.org. That's practicalbioethics.org. Thaddeus Pope joins us. He is director of the Health Law Institute and an associate professor of law at Hamline University School of Law in St. Paul, Minnesota. He co-authored an article in the Journal of the American Medical Association entitled "The Courts, Futility, and the Ends of Medicine." You write in your article that different states are taking different approaches with this question of whether medical futility disputes should be decided in court. Give us an idea, if you would please, of how this question is playing out in various states across the country.
And I guess I would just edit one thing maybe that you said, which is implies that perhaps many states are taking a lot of different approaches.
Okay.
And perhaps one of the things that Dr. White and I were arguing is that most states aren't doing anything whatsoever. And so I guess that's one thing I just wanted to clarify. And you know, I think the reason there is that many state legislatures are afraid to touch this issue because it's so very politically sensitive. But to be responsive to your question, the big difference in terms of state variations in approaching this problem would be, as we wrote, to contrast Texas with the majority approach. You know, Texas on the one hand and all the other states on the other hand. And so in most states, there is no specific law that would authorize a physician to stop providing medical treatment. Usually in futility context, we're talking about life-sustaining treatment, ventilators, dialysis, artificial nutrition and hydration, and things like that. There's no law that allows the physician to unilaterally stop or refuse such treatment where the patient or the surrogate doesn't consent to that. And so for the physician to unilaterally stop any of that treatment without consent presents some legal risk to the physician. In Texas, on the other hand, the statute clearly and expressly authorizes physicians to be able to stop providing life-sustaining treatment that they think is non-beneficial or otherwise inappropriate, and they have civil, criminal, and disciplinary immunity for doing so, so long as an institutional committee, usually an ethics committee, agrees that stopping or refusal was appropriate.
It seems from what you write that you're searching for an answer that's somewhere in between, suggesting a limited role for the courts in these types of cases. Would it be fair to say that?
Absolutely. That's exactly, I think, what we were trying to get across, which is, on the one hand, these conflicts are very frequent. The literature is rather robust that end-of-life conflict in the ICU is a frequent occurrence, and therefore it would be ridiculous for all these cases to be resolved in court. Happily, most of the time, through additional communication with the treatment team or with the involvement of social workers, clergy, or ethics consultants, consensus is reached almost all the time, right? The court process is too cumbersome, too slow, too public, too adversarial to be an appropriate forum for the day-to-day end-of-life conflict or futility conflict. So absolutely, that's right. Nevertheless, one of our points we wanted to say is that the courts still have a role to play, because all of this intramural discussion, you know, in the walls of the hospital, needs to have some guidance from the legislature or the courts. And as I said a second ago, they're not getting it from the legislatures. So our hope is that the courts need to take a few of these cases just to provide some guidance for the ethics consultants and the other hospital staff when they are the ones dealing with it on a day-to-day basis.
So we're looking for this balance of where, kind of what side of the equation you benefit, whether it's the individual case or if it's the benefits at the societal level. And I guess that's hard to discern which is which and to try to create that balance.
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, if you contrast this back to going back 30 years or so, right, you have a handful of cases, really. In not every state even has its own case, right? In Missouri, you have the Cruzan case, and in New Jersey, they have Quinlan and a handful of other cases. But obviously, there's a lot more, there are many, many more conflicts over end-of-life treatment than just those cases. But at least in those states, you have a framework, right, and some guidelines enunciated in those cases that help shape and frame the discussion at the bedside. And so in all the cases that are going to happen in 2012, 99%+ of those do not need to go to court, should not go to court. But at least with futility, where we have very, very few court cases and very, very few legislative guidelines, one of our key points is that some of those cases should go to court so they can provide a little bit of guidance to all the other cases, and also so it can prompt a much, much needed broader social debate about these issues, because they're a little bit under discussed, under analyzed, and courts they are public, and therefore it would prompt a social, much needed social debate.
Well, you cover this somewhat in the three potential benefits that you list in your article for preserving appeals to court in these kinds of disputes. And one of those is to encourage intensive communication. Talk to us about that.
Well, what we've heard, and we know this as a matter of our mediation and alternative dispute resolution in general, but we also have seen this in particular in Texas, which is that where there's no right of appeal to the courts, in one party, and in Texas it's the providers, holds all of the cards, there's less incentive to meaningfully participate in a negotiation or mediation process, which takes time. And, you know, if you think, look, what the family is asking me to do, if you're the physician and you think what the family is asking me to do here is just wrong, it's outside the standard of care, it's even cruel to do this to the patient, I'm just not going to do it. And rather than perhaps what you would have to do in other states, because you don't have a legislative alternative like you do in Texas, so in other states you'll really have to sit down and try to educate the family about why you think your treatment recommendation is appropriate. And there's less of an incentive to do that in Texas, because you can just call your ethics committee. Most of the time they do agree with the attending physician, and you can proceed as you see appropriate without engaging in the intensive communication. So that's why we argued that having an appeal to the courts, in other words, evening out the balance of power between the physicians and the family, would likely lead to a greater incentive to more meaningfully engage in intensive communication.
A second benefit, as you put it in this article, is to cast a shadow that allows extrajudicial solutions. So allowing the court a little bit of flexibility to address an issue that other parties in the dispute may not have, correct?
Right, and I think a lot of this second benefit here is what I got into a minute ago when I was talking about the courts providing guidance, right? If they take 1 out of 100 cases, or 1 out of 1,000 cases, or 1 out of 10,000 cases, actually goes to a court and actually results in a written judicial opinion, then that one case out of 1,000 will provide a shadow, right? And all of the other 999 cases will be resolved in the shadow of the one litigated case. And that's the way it works in all of the other areas of the law, right? Most disputes get settled, right? They don't even go to court. And even the ones that are filed in court, most of those don't result in a jury verdict or a written judicial opinion. They're settled. And when the parties engage in those settlement negotiations, they look to, well, what would happen if we did go all the way? And the way in which you determine that is by looking to the published law. So here, what we lack in the futility context is enough published law to tell the parties what would happen if this went to court. And that would help facilitate the informal negotiation and mediation that happens outside court.
Since this article has been published, what kind of response have you received from your professional colleagues and others?
Well, I mean, this is a very controversial area, and you know, so some people are supportive, and some others are not. I mean, and so there's lots of I guess I've gotten responses both ways. And it goes to everything from the framing of the issue. I mean, that's been one of the big issues in futility for 25 years, which is, you know, we use the phrase, just as an example, we use the phrase medical decision, implying that there are decisions that are medical decisions and implying that there are other decisions that are non-medical decisions. And so some comments, you know, or that why did you imply that there is such a thing as a pure medical decision? There is no such thing, and that may be right. And so even down to the very terminology and the very concepts that we use to even describe the issue and make arguments about the issue are themselves, you know, in matters of controversy.
A former colleague here at the Center for Practical Bioethics, Bill Colby, once said that the black and white of the law is only so effective in the massive gray area of serious illness and dying. He should know, of course, because of his role as attorney for the family of Nancy Kruzan. But it still seems like we're struggling to find out where to draw a line, if not a black line, in cases like these, or if a line should exist at all. Would you agree with that?
I think that's right. I think we are. We've been struggling for a long time. I think this issue is much harder than the Kruzan issue because there, in the end, if you trust the family, you know, which I think is what the Kruzan case was largely about, right? Do you trust the family to speak on behalf of Nancy? It's a question of will we give Nancy what we, you know, determine she would have wanted for herself? And in the futility context, one of the core issues is when can we refuse to give people what it is that they want for themselves, whether they're speaking themselves or through their surrogates. And so this is, you know, arguably a much greater encroachment on patient autonomy, because there are people who may want to have stayed alive longer, or at least wanted to try to stay alive longer, and the physicians may think that that's to provide that life-sustaining treatment is inappropriate. So I think where do we draw that line? Absolutely. No consensus in society, no consensus even within the medical profession. We have a couple lines, right? Brain death, that's actually not with DCD. Even that's getting even fuzzier. But at least that used to be one line, right? We don't need to provide life-sustaining treatment to people who are dead. But past that, we don't have a lot of other clear lines. And you're right, that we are struggling.
Attius Pope is director of the Health Law Institute and an associate professor of law at Hamline University School of Law in St. Paul, Minnesota. He co-authored an article in the Journal of the American Medical Association entitled The Courts, Futility, and the Ends of Medicine. I'm Lorella Boone. Thanks for listening to the Bioethics Channel.